Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I am Matt Gerandaisi.
And we are the Shock Doctors. On this episode, we're going to be discussing James Gunn's superhero horror hybrid, Brightburn. Now, I say it's James Gunn's film, but really, it's written by two of his brothers and directed by a man named David Yarovesky, with whom I am not particularly familiar. But it was produced by James Gunn, and it's regarded generally as, at least in part, kind of his brainchild.
Yeah. Horror movies do this more often than any other genre, I find. Like, God help you if you directed a horror movie that Guillermo del Toro produced, because everyone will just assume that he directed it, and it will be marketed as such. That's true of the new Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark movie. It was true of Mama back in 2013, I think. It just happens over and over again.
In fairness, it seems like, particularly with Del Toro, these are a lot of projects that like started out as ones he wanted to direct, and then he just realized that his time is finite.
Right.
So he had to hand some of them off. But anyway, Brightburn, it's...
Or as I prefer to call it, we need to talk about Kal-El. I can't be the first person who's made that joke. If I am, then shame on the rest of you, because it's been staring you in the face. You fools.
If that's the case, you heard it here first, and don't you forget it.
Yeah, when we finally make Shock Doctors merch that's going on a mug or something.
Basically, the premise of Brightburn is that, as you may have guessed from Matt's riff just now, it's more or less what would have happened if Superman, Kal-El, Clark Kent, were not such a nice guy.
Yeah, it's Superman by way of the Omen, basically. It's what if Superman, but evil.
So, bearing that in mind, Matt, how about you kick off our synopsis?
Opening shot is of a bookshelf. We can hear a man and a woman kind of getting frisky. In the background, we pan over not just one, but like eight or nine, a good half dozen at least, books on fertility. So we immediately intuit that this couple is having trouble conceiving, kind of, you know, how is Babby formed, that kind of thing. We pan over to the bed. The man and woman are canoodling, and there's a crash out in the yard, and they go out to investigate. There's been a meteor impact. If you know Superman's origin story, we're pretty much off to the races at this point. We then cut to a montage of home video footage of the bouncing baby boy that they reclaimed from the smoldering wreck in the backyard.
The ominous glowing red meteor.
Yeah. And we cut to 10, 11 years later. Mother and son are playing hide and seek out in the barn. He jump scares her. Obligatory first act fake out jump scare. Gets her real good. Next day, the boy, his name is Brandon, is in school, and we get one of those stock horror movie scenes that basically I don't think have been done well since the original Halloween, where Jamie Lee Curtis like is looking out the window and, you know, not listening to her professor prattling on about, you know, fate and mortality or whatever else. In this particular instance, we're getting an earful about bees and wasps, and Brandon gets called on by the teach, and he goes into a little spiel about how so there's a certain genus of wasps who are a predatory invasive species who force other species to raise their offspring, which is a big red flag, a big red cape.
He knows a little too much about this phenomenon.
Yeah, he's a child prodigy, essentially. He's in like the upper 1% of 1% of kids in his peer group, and he's, as we're about to learn, very physically durable, let's say.
Yes.
He goes out sleepwalking that night. His mother calls it sleepwalking. Really, he's in some kind of a fugue state. He's chanting. His eyes are glowing red. She doesn't see that, but we do. And he's hearing an alien language in his head that sounds like a dubstep remix of Sauron, I think is how I would describe it. Or maybe like Sauron if he was underwater. You know, that kind of like, that sort of, you know, every time someone handles the One Ring, basically.
But
that
yeah, kind of it's noise. A little more rhythmic. I see what you're getting at with dubstep.
Yeah, and there's like a little bit of a distortion filter on it, which can alternately make it sound like techno music heard from half a block away, or like I said, someone underwater kind of gurgling.
So he's in this trance, and he's trying to get underneath this trap door out in the barn that's locked up, and he's just rattling the doors repeatedly, and his mother is trying to wake him up and eventually gets over to him and kind of jostles him awake, and he's very alarmed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was very much not himself for a second there. And so I think most of us in the audience infer that underneath this locked trap door in the barn is the spacecraft in which he was swaddled as an infant. Although I don't think that's supposed to be like a big third act reveal, is it?
I don't think so.
Yeah, it's not explicitly shown, but it's
glowing with the same red. Yeah, there's nothing else it could be.
Yeah, exactly. So the following day, Brandon is attempting to mow the lawn, and the pull cord is giving him grief. The lawnmower isn't starting, and so he throws the lawnmower without meaning to a good 100 yards or more, which
probably more.
Like, same. You know, I've had days where I wanted to hurl my lawnmower into orbit. So that's the sole point in this movie where I was 100% on board with Brandon as a character. Like, really, there was some powerful identification going on there. We then get really just a pile up of incidents, a succession of scenes in which all is not well with Brandon.
Yeah, it starts out with him walking out to where the lawnmower is, and it's kind of upended and the blade is spinning because he managed to start it in the course of flinging it.
And then hurling it into the stratosphere like Team Rocket. Yeah.
And he's back in a little bit of a trance state, and we hear the chanting again, and he's just reaching his hand in to the blades. And I don't know why they dragged out the suspense for so long. I don't think anyone really expected that he'd cut off his own fingers. But yeah.
That would have been wild, though.
That would have been very unexpected.
Yeah.
And that's what drives him to madness. No, he sticks his hand in, and sure enough, it breaks the blade.
Yeah, it's weird because it feels like it happens really soon, right? Like a movie like Unbreakable can milk that moment for a lot of suspense, right? Because you don't know if he's actually impervious. But here we get confirmation, what, like 15 minutes into the movie, maybe? I mean, I guess
it's
awfully front loaded.
I guess the distinction between the two is Unbreakable is supposed to be more about, well, is he really a superhero and the nature of being a superhero? And this is like, no, this is a kid with superhuman abilities.
Yeah.
Let's get doing bad
stuff. All the marketing has pretty much given the game away. So I guess, yeah, no harm, no foul. But then, like, the succession of kind of we need to talk about Kevin-esque moments that come later just feel lower stakes than the lawnmower scene. So the first is he's at his birthday party at some kind of a bowling alley or an arcade, and his aunt and uncle get him a rifle for his birthday, and his dad's like, whoa, no way, Jose.
Too soon.
Yeah, I mean, they live in Kansas, but apparently even there, you know, they're a little, I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, he takes Brandon out hunting and stuff. So he's definitely not like hostile to guns on principle, but I guess he believes that 12 is too young even for Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
So
Brandon throws a little bit of a hissy fit, talks back to his folks, and
which is apparently unprecedented.
Right. Yeah. So they blame it on puberty and move on with their lives. A shocking amount of Brandon's misbehavior in this movie is just credited to puberty, which is, you know, an old horror staple. I mean, Carrie is all about that. Brandon goes to town on a fork in the next scene over breakfast. He's eating scrambled eggs. And then you just hear this very disconcerting, like, silverware in a garbage disposal kind of noise. And he has just mangled this fork with his teeth without really meaning to. Once again, he's in a little bit of a trance state.
And he looks alarmed afterwards when he takes it out of his mouth.
Yeah, none of us are alarmed, needless to say, because we've already seen what he can do to a spinning rotor blade that should have taken off his hand. So the idea that he can, yeah, I don't know, that just the scenes looked out of order to me, just in an escalation sense.
Yeah.
His parents then find his porn stash. Another classic coming-of-age ritual for boys on the edge of puberty.
But there's a twist, because it starts out with catalog pictures of women in bras and, you know, all the normal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then
Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition kind of material.
Yeah, and then it starts getting into, like, weird human body internal diagrams.
Yeah, like anatomical charts.
And then after that, it's just some, like, indeterminate viscera. I don't know whether it was supposed to be human or animal.
It just looked like a pile of roadkill or something. I don't know. But yeah, but they're not as put off by this as they perhaps ought to be. I mean, you could explain it as if this were a normal child, which we know it isn't because we bought a ticket for Brightburn on the basis of the trailer for Brightburn. But, it, you know, if it were a normal kid and I were his parent, I would think like, okay, obviously this is a things I don't want my parents to see box. Not a things I jerk off to box, because
right.
That's 1,000 times more horrifying. But they don't even, like, take it that far, you know, they don't even
process that distinction.
Yeah, they don't resort to making those kinds of rationalizations, which I thought was rung hollow for me. But they're concerned enough that the dad takes the boy hunting that weekend and tries to give him the talk, you know, the birds and the bees conversation, and Brandon is just a real weirdo about it. He takes completely the wrong message from it, because what follows is him harassing his classmate crush at night when she's in her bedroom. Her laptop starts acting up, playing a spooky old would-be romantic song. It's the, you know, classic horror device these days. It's the same thing that all the Insidious movies kept trying to do to Tiny Tim: take something innocuous and make it spooky.
So I think it works a little better here than
little,
Tiny Tim does.
Well, yeah, because
it's silly.
Yeah, it is. So he's creeping on her basically, and like lurking behind her curtains, and
of course, once she gets her mom in the room, the mom cannot find the kid.
Yeah. I thought that this scene could have, in different hands, or maybe this is what it was going for, I'm not sure, been sort of a funny, subversive riff on, like, Stephanie Meyer-style YA chick lit, with, like the, you know, the whole I watch you while you sleep thing being romantic.
Right.
Like kind of an FU to that whole idea, but it doesn't really pursue that, because the girl, who I think is named Caitlin,
yes,
is disturbed by this whole interaction, does not find it romantic, which is, you know, appropriate, and fosters a grudge against Brandon for the remainder of the movie.
Yeah. So the next scene really of any consequence is gym class.
Yep.
They're doing some kind of trust exercise where they kind of like, there's an awful lot of like pushing for a trust exercise, but they put a kid in the middle of a circle of his classmates and kind of just gently push him back and forth.
Yeah, well, he's supposed to go limp and just it's trust falls, but with a whole ring of people standing around you,
sort of pushing back and forth.
But there's a weak link in this chain.
Well, yeah, they do it with one kid and it passes off without incident, and then it's Brandon's turn, and Caitlin is side eyeing him real hard, does not want to touch him.
Yeah,
and so when it comes to her to give him a gentle nudge back into the circle, she audibly says ew and sidesteps him, and he falls to the ground hard.
Mm-hmm.
Brandon does not take this well.
No.
He kind of glowers on the ground.
I think he has a perpetual glower from here until the end of the movie.
Pretty much. This is where it kicks off.
Yeah.
And she says, I don't want to touch him, he's a pervert. The gym teacher doesn't know the backstory, obviously, and insists that she help him up or she's going to fail the class. And so when she finally reluctantly puts out her hand, Brandon takes it and proceeds to utterly crush it.
You just squeeze it into jelly, basically.
Yeah.
So he gets in hot water for this, but being a minor, there's not a whole lot of consequences in the grand scheme of thing.
Something about which Caitlin's mother is justifiably angry.
Yeah, sure. So he's, I think, suspended for 2 days.
Yep.
And then he has to start meeting with the school counselor, who happens to be his aunt, the same one who was at his birthday party.
Yes.
We then get another sleepwalking, kind of somnambulistic trance scene, where this time he's translating, I think, the Sauron gobbledygook.
Yeah, he keeps repeating like one word over and over, and then finally saying the word in English.
Yeah, so we get take, and then the, and then it's just take the for a long time. They're obviously think that we're on the edge of our seat waiting for that final.
I think, in fact, it's like another scene where he finally gets the third word. It's take the world.
It's take the world is the, you know, because again, he's an invasive species.
He's an invasive wasp.
Mm-hmm. So this time, if memory serves, he gets the trap door off its hinges and falls into the crawl space or the basement underneath the barn and cuts himself on the alien spacecraft in which he arrived. So right away, we've got our kryptonite, right? It's the only thing that's ever cut him. This has been established, and he's very alarmed that he, you know, no one makes me bleed my own blood, that kind of thing. And this is where his mother kind of pats him on the head and tells him
his origin story.
Yeah, we didn't get you from an adoption agency. We found you in the woods in this thing. And we, you know, we were trying to get pregnant for so long. You were a blessing. She really does everything right. She is very gracious about the whole situation, especially what a sullen little turd he's been lately. But he freaks out. It's the whole "you lied to me" thing. He goes ballistic. I think this is when we get the "take the world" thing. He like runs outside. This is the first time we get laser eyes.
Yep.
He shoots his laser eyes directly into the camera, which and lets out this kind of pubescent shriek that's not very scary.
Yeah.
As kind of, you know, voice cracking moment. And then he goes to harass his crush again. She's working on an essay on her computer. The title is "The Decline of Truth and Justice in Modern America," I think, or the modern era.
And it's written in Comic Sans.
It's written in Comic Sans. So obviously Superman stood for truth, justice, and the American way. So this is kind of thumbing its nose at that, I guess, or some kind of refutation to that. I thought that could have been a little interesting since we're supposedly living through this post-truth political epoch right now, but they don't really take that idea anywhere. So she is confronted by Brandon again. She's still terrified of him, more so than ever now that her hand is jelly. And she says, "My mom told me not to talk to you." He says something like, "Oh yeah, I'm going to straighten that out. Don't worry about it."
And then he poofs just as quickly as he appeared, mm-hmm. leaving some flowers that he brought for her.
Mm-hmm.
It's the next scene where we're back in the... It was a diner where they had his birthday party, some kind of local landmark. And it's also where Caitlin's mother, Erica, of the angry parent-teacher meeting from earlier, works.
Yeah, she's closing up shop, looks like. She's the only one there.
Yeah. And so as she's closing up, she hears a weird noise, and suddenly when she looks at the kind of dirty, oily windows, there's a bunch of symbols drawn in them. And it's a symbol that we're familiar with because it's something that Brandon has spent much of the film up to this point drawing.
Yeah, he's been doodling it on his notebook.
It's one of those classic kids drawn weird letter shapes in their notebooks when they're not paying attention in school sort of things. It's kind of like a jagged back-to-back sort of Janus-faced B.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Brandon Breyer. Breyer is his last name. I don't know if we've mentioned that yet.
I don't believe so. But yeah, it's alliterative because superheroes.
Also, obviously, Brightburn plays into that as well.
Yeah.
And so there's a bunch of those all over the windows. So if we didn't know before, we know now that it's Brandon. And at first she just thinks it's one of her coworkers messing with her. And then
the lights above her head are flickering. This is something else we haven't touched on. Brandon's power set in this movie, it's like Superman by way of a poltergeist. Like he can just fuck with technology the way that ghosts do in movies. They make lights flicker, they make radios turn to static, they can turn radios on at spooky times. Mm. You know, that kind of they can give people car trouble, cuz horror movies, you know, the car never starts promptly. He does a lot of that in this movie, and we'll get into why that didn't quite work for me later. But as of right now, he's making the lights flicker. She's looking up at the fluorescent bar above her head, and then the glass shatters.
And a piece of it ends up in one of her eyes.
Holy shit. It's It's so much more hardcore. It's an order of magnitude more hardcore than anything that preceded it. We get this long, drawn-out sequence of her.
It's zombie in reverse.
Yeah, the Lucio Fulci zombie. Yes, exactly. That's exactly what it is. And she reaches into her eyeball to, like, extricate this shard of glass. We see her eyeball deflate, basically, and, like, you know, like a geyser of blood. It's really... They really milk it for all it's worth. It's pretty gratuitous. And then she flees into the freezer to escape her assailant. And Brandon breaks the door down with a mixture of strength and heat vision. And then just guns for her, just at the speed of light. If you've seen any of the Henry Cavill Superman movies, you know the way that Superman like zips around these days like the Roadrunner. That's basically what happens. He just, wham, he gets her. Smash cut to a bowl of oatmeal being stirred, which is also like
a really like kind of gruesome slop noise, just like thwack.
Yeah, which
bowl.
Is like, it would have be like a cheeky wink wink kind of, we don't want to depict violence, so here's a cut that just implies it thing, except it follows right on the heels of a fucking Lucio Fulci moment.
it's eyeball blood geyser,
completely out of place. And it just, the oatmeal looks like my co-host said, like slop. Like, put some cinnamon sugar on that thing, for fuck's sake. It looks like gruel. So Brandon then, his bloodlust is not yet satiated. I think he's had at this point a counseling session with his aunt and just been a total ice-blooded sociopath through the whole thing. No remorse.
She's basically like, you know, I have to update the sheriff and the school and your mom. I'm giving you a chance. And he's just like, yeah, no. Sometimes bad things happen for a reason. So, yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's like he crushed an ant underfoot or something. He just, because at this point he thinks of himself as a higher form of life. He basically says as much right to her face.
He does say as much.
Yeah, which is, again, more alarm bells should be going off. But it's fine. She intends to take it up with the sheriff or some higher authority. So then he subsequently goes to her house at night and intimidates her, threatens her implicitly, and she says, you know, this isn't appropriate. You should go home. And she's menaced for a little while. He's zipping around all over the place, but nothing really comes of it because then her husband gets home. He was at the bar. He's got some liquor in his system, and he finds Brandon
in his closet
wearing a makeshift mask.
Which is not the first time we've seen it. We haven't mentioned it yet, but it's got kind of a weird vertical mouth looking design, except it's just like shoelace sort of.
Yeah, it's just a big piece of like sackcloth or burlap or something. He looks like Jason in the second Friday the 13th movie before they hit upon the hockey mask look. He's, you know, he looks like a backwoods murderer. He's got a little ratty cape on too, but it doesn't do much to mitigate the overall slasher aesthetic. And the dad's like, he yanks the mask off of him and is like, why are you in my closet with a creepy mask on? And Brandon goes, it's not creepy, which I liked because it indicates that it is actually a sloppy attempt to make a superhero costume, which I find weirdly endearing. And he wasn't like trying to be Freddy Krueger. That's one of the only kind of human touches in his writing or his performance in like the back half of this movie.
So Uncle Noah is very displeased, and he's going to take Brandon home to his parents. Brandon doesn't want his parents to know that bad things have been happening, which is not the first time we've heard this. It was part of the threat to his aunt as well. Noah tries to get him to get in the car, and then Brandon pulls his poof act, eventually hurling Noah against his own garage door.
Yeah, he starts roadrunnering all over the place, you know, meep, that kind of, you know, the drill.
Noah gets in the truck and flees, leaves his wife at home helpless.
Yeah.
Doesn't even consider her. And then they have kind of a cat and mouse, bee and wasp, if you will, sort of thing on this rural road, not like no lights whatsoever, going through like woods. And to make a long story short, it ends with Brandon lifting the truck with his mind, I guess. At first, I thought just the way it was shot and angled and stuff that he was picking it up physically, but he's nowhere near it.
Yeah, that was odd. I mean, it's dark, but it's I don't know. It's hard to say. Yeah. His powers are kind of ill-defined anyway.
Right.
I was hoping that they would just be more rigorous about what if Superman but evil. But right. it's a lot messier than that.
We'll
get to that after the break.
So he picks up the truck and then drops it kind of front end first into the ground, which results in Noah's mouth / jaw slamming into the steering wheel and just turning into a shattered mess.
Yeah.
Jaw's kind of hanging off.
This is our second gratuitous gore moment. Second of two, really, at least that have this much attention lavished on them.
Yeah, because we see a lot of that, like, jaw CG gore.
He's like trying to hold it in place
with his hand. Yeah. And Brandon doesn't even like kill him at that point. He just kind of like stares at him ominously and then lets him bleed out.
No, because does he though? Because then Ma and Pa Kent, for all intents and purposes, what are their names? Tori and
Kyle
get a call in the middle of the night and they show up to the hospital. So, and the aunt is there and she's like, they won't let me see him.
I'm pretty sure that was supposed to be a morgue.
A morgue. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
That's okay.
They don't want to.
Oh, that's right. He does die. He for sure dies.
Because he stops moving.
Yeah. Well, so. I mean, and then, right. So they realize, because the aunt was like, did Brandon make it home okay? So then they realize that he had been out to her place, which puts him more or less at the scene of the crime. And
Kyle jumps to the correct conclusion more or less immediately. Tori does not want to believe it.
Yeah, he starts going, you know, he's not our son. We found him in the woods. You know, that kind of thing.
And she's not having it.
They try to give Brandon the, you know, they try to break the news to him that his uncle has died under tragic and mysterious and violent circumstances. And Brandon is completely unmoved.
The line is, I feel like you want me to cry or something.
Right. And that leads to an altercation with him and his dad where he evinces a little bit of super strength, but not too much. He's still exercising an incredible amount of restraint.
But he does hurl his dad into like an interior glass door.
Yeah, he shoves him with more strength than the average 12-year-old would be able to muster. And the dad says to the wife after this, you know, things have been getting heated around here. I'm gonna take the boy hunting again this weekend. You know, I'm just gonna be his dad. I'm gonna give him a good talking to, and we'll sort all this out.
Kyle is trying to do the right thing here.
He's going about it all wrong. But yeah.
As we find out.
Yeah. So they're off on their hunting trip. Brandon is walking ahead of his dad, who is sweating with his, you know, hand
with
finger,
his rifle.
With his finger on the trigger.
This is intercut with a scene of the sheriff showing up to their house and showing Tori the back-to-back BB symbol, which was on the windows. And also Brandon drew it in his uncle's blood on the roadside next to the wreck.
So I don't know what theory the sheriff has concocted at this point, but he has got he's
made the logical leap that these are two bees and Brandon Breyer. I don't think if I were a sheriff who knew none of these details that I would make that jump, but I guess they're trying to just a little bit of a narrative shortcut.
Yeah, I think more likely if they found that insignia drawn in blood at two different crime scenes, there it would just trigger a new satanic panic, at least in Kansas.
Right, you know,
they would think it was the work of Satanists for sure.
So the sheriff tries to show Tori a picture of that, and it's like, yeah, that doesn't look like anything to me.
Yeah, she goes full mama bear and just stonewalls him.
Yeah, so he's like, okay, well, you know, I'll be back. She goes up into his room, finds his notebook, which is just papered first with the symbol and then with pen drawings of all of his
myriad crimes. Yeah.
Yeah. The hand crushing and the face melting and so forth and the car breaking.
Yeah, climaxing with a full-page spread, comic book style. I actually wish they'd embraced that more. I wish his doodles had been done in panels.
Yeah.
That would have been kind of clever. But the finale of this little sojourn through her psycho son's journal is a two-page spread of him annihilating the world with his fire eyes, basically.
So, back to Brandon and Kyle. Brandon is kneeling and examining like some deer tracks, and Kyle's gonna do what needs doing, or the way he thinks it needs to be done. And he aims and he pulls the trigger and shoots Brandon in the back of the head. But of course, it doesn't do anything.
Yeah, like, Brandon is vulnerable. He's been hit with a pebble or something.
And of course, Brandon's like, well, cool.
Just went to the top of my shit list.
Yeah, right.
So, then the dad gets his head heat visioned off, basically.
Yeah.
Then Brandon returns home, starts antagonizing his mother, who calls the Fuzz. They show up en masse.
Well, no, there's two of them.
Yeah. Well, there's two squad cars. No, you're right. There's just two of them.
It's the sheriff and one deputy in two separate cars.
Yeah, you're
and
right.
And the sheriff gets turned into absolute pulp almost immediately.
Yeah, he gets roadrunnered off screen. There's a lot of that in the third act of this movie. The climax, I guess, is where we're at now.
Yeah, the deputy gets repeatedly bashed and kind of gurgles and bleeds to death, more or less, like Noah. And
Mom leaps out a window to safety, cuts herself somehow on her descent, looks at the cut on her palm, and then exclaims, the ship, that cut him. Be like, okay.
That's a little more than we needed.
Her looking at the cut, then at the barn, then back at the cut, then at the barn would have been fine. You could probably even cut that down a little bit. Her just saying the ship probably would have been fine for like communicating to the audience that there's been a eureka moment here. But the ship that cut him is, entirely too much.
Just a little clunky.
So she then proceeds to try to make good on that plan. She runs into the barn. There's a repeat of the hide and seek scene from the beginning of the movie, where she's going, Brandon, Brandon.
And they have a kind of like call and response whistle that they do.
Mm-hmm.
So we finally get payoff for that.
The only thing I liked about this sequence was when she's in the barn, in the basement of the barn, when she recovers a bit of shrapnel from the alien spacecraft, there's a pretty sick reveal of the aunt's body, which has gone missing.
It's not the aunt's body. It's Erica, it's the waitress. It's Caitlin's
That's what
mom.
I meant. Yeah, the waitress's body mounted and disemboweled on the wall in the red glare from the spaceship. I was not expecting that. That was kind of the one moment where this movie kind of got the drop on me a little bit. And I like that it wasn't punctuated with a jump scare either. It's just like,
it's just there,
there
and then
is.
Tori gets scared.
Yes.
But yeah, we see it the whole time.
Yeah.
So she manages to pry off a jagged piece of shrapnel from the ship and then kind of drops in her back pocket and then tries to calm down Brandon and play mom.
Yeah, it's the classic werewolf silver bullet moment where they're always shot by someone who loves them.
Yeah.
You know, for pathos sake.
So they hug and she's doing the classic, you know, one hand around him, one hand going to her back pocket and lifting it up.
Very slowly raising the blade, yeah.
And sure enough, as she tries to bring it down, his super reflexes grab her wrist. And just like Kyle, I thought this was funny. Both times they, like, try and reason with him after they murder him.
Oh, shit,
like,
my bad.
Like, I don't know if that works, but we can get into that.
No, Kyle's is even more pathetic.
Yeah.
But hers is pretty bad, too. So he then takes them into the stratosphere, practically, like, above the cloud line. They just, boom, through the roof. And
he drops her.
Yeah, and he drops her.
And that's basically the end of the movie. It cuts to black, and then we have...
Well, there's a plane starts bearing...
Oh, that's right.
A plane starts bearing down on him, like a commercial airliner, cut to black, and then fade in on a bunch of burning fuselage, you know, strewn all across their homestead.
So, as far as anyone knows, Tori and Kyle, even though Kyle was killed far away, presumably they never found his body. Maybe Brandon went and grabbed it. I don't know.
Maybe, yeah.
But they think that the parents died in the plane crash, which obliterated the house, also explains all the damage to the house.
Uh-huh.
And then it's just kind of a montage of...
Over the credits now.
Yeah, over the credits now of Brandon doing creepy shit and, like, look at this mysterious figure in Brightburn that's destroying office buildings and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the closing segment of that montage, which is maybe the best part of the movie.
I think so, yes.
As far as I'm concerned, we have Michael Rooker, who is a James Gunn staple
mm-hmm.
for all the reasons. playing kind of an Alex Jones conspiracy theorist type.
Kind of. Yeah, no, he's got like the InfoWars-y backdrop and everything. I mean, it's pretty, yeah, it's pretty unmistakable.
Talking about the Brightburn menace and like half a dozen other cryptozoological terrors.
Yeah, which seemed like a really half-assed, like expanded universe kind of thing, like a chomping at an MCU kind of sequel bait, sequel hook sort of idea. But yeah, no, I mean, other than that, which I thought was a little clumsy, I did appreciate him showing up. As you figure, there aren't going to be any big celebrity cameos once the credits are already rolling. Only thing that could have made that sequence better was if they roped in a little bit of like Glenn Beck iconography and he wheeled out a blackboard and started like circling shit. That would have been a fun throwback. Anyway, that brings us to the end of our synopsis.
So we're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with our thoughts in just a moment.
Maybe there is something wrong with Brandon.
I will never turn against our son.
He's not my son!
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break, to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Whatever you've done, I know there is good inside you.
I want to do good, Mom. I do.
And we're back. So, Matt, what do you got?
So, I went into this movie with a little bit of a sour disposition to begin with because it's being marketed as this genre-bending exercise, like an unprecedented genre-bending exercise, like the birth of a new genre, basically. And I'm just not buying it. Like, that New Mutants movie that apparently is never coming out could have beaten this movie to the punch if it had just been released in a timely manner, like when originally slated. So I really don't think it's that novel, you know. Sam Raimi did Darkman. Fucking Wes Craven did Swamp Thing. Horror and superheroes. There's not like a long lineage there, but it has been done. Toxic Avenger. Chronicle isn't even that different from this, if you think about it. They're, you just age them up 6-7 years.
It's true.
And I was even thinking, watching this, that like, you know, this would have been scarier if instead of like What If Superman but horror, you did that but for Spider-Man, because that lends itself to a bit more of like a Cronenbergian thing.
Sure. Yeah.
But then I was like, oh no, but that movie already exists. I think it's a sci-fi original. It's called Earth versus the Spider. Haven't seen it, but the cover used to scare me when I was a kid in Blockbuster Video. I would always browse the horror section but never actually rent anything because I was too chicken shit. But yeah, Earth versus the Spider. Exactly what I just described. It's Brightburn, but for Spider-Man, starring Dan Aykroyd, I think.
Yeah, and in case it hasn't come up before, Matt is, he has a thing about spiders.
Yeah, they're pure evil. I think when you say that I have, yeah, what, doesn't everybody? Like, it honestly doesn't occur to me that the entire population of this planet isn't profoundly arachnophobic, because they're just such little Satan spawn that it beggars belief that anyone could not find them just absolutely repugnant. Yeah. Even Super, which is a James Gunn joint from the early 2010s, is kind of a meditation of sorts on this same idea. That's the one where Rainn Wilson goes around braining people with a pipe wrench, I think. I never actually saw it, but it makes no odds. The point is that James Gunn has done this kind of thing before. What if superheroes, but somehow grislier or gorier? You get the idea.
Yeah.
So I think just on a genre bending front, Brightburn is a little too impressed with itself. It thinking it's hot shit is a little bit of a problem, because then it doesn't try hard enough. I feel like if it had been more, and maybe it's just a marketing thing, trailer hyperbole is an epidemic. I don't want to rake the movie over the coals over that. But it's just not anywhere near as novel as it thinks it is.
Yeah. I think a big problem with this movie for me, and I think Matt touched on this a little bit earlier, and I just want to say first that I didn't mind this movie overall. I thought it was fine. But a big drawback to this movie is that it, like we talked about with The Prodigy, you know, we're dealing with the creepy kid.
It's exactly thing. I couldn't get The Prodigy out of my head the whole time we were watching it.
And at least Brightburn's got a little bit more going on,
mm-hmm.
so it doesn't have to be scary. And there are a couple of moments in Brightburn that are legitimately kind of alarming, whereas there was not a single moment in The Prodigy.
Yeah, well, Prodigy never went full Fulci, which, you know.
Well, I'm not even talking about that. Like, there were suspenseful moments where I was a little bit on edge in Brightburn, okay. and The Prodigy, no, not at all.
Sure.
But, yes, it still has that creepy kid problem, mm-hmm. where people think creepy kids are really scary, and they're not so much.
Kids that look, you know, when I say kids, I mean, like, between, like, 7 and, like, 13, maybe. When they look annoyed, that almost can't be scary, because they just look like they're throwing a fit. They just look petulant. Prodigy had this problem with, like, the perpetual glaring. Brandon in Brightburn has this problem. It even came up in one of the trailers. Annabelle comes home, the little girl, going, "Can I play with Annabelle?" And then she, like, glares.
Yeah.
At the, you know, like, glares just aren't scary coming from kids. It just makes me want to put them on timeout.
Yeah.
Blank expression. Like, no expression at all would be better than having little kids look angry. It just doesn't convey any menace.
Yeah.
Ever. I mean, I hate speaking in absolutes, but I can't think of a single time that it's worked for me.
Yeah, I struggle to find one as well. So, yeah, this movie just leans a little bit too much. Again, not as much as The Prodigy, but mm-hmm. but kind of close.
Yeah.
On the creepy kid thing. And I don't know how you get around that. I mean, honestly, you probably could have just aged the kid up. Like,
just a little, yeah.
Like, put the kid in high school. Angry teenagers aren't, like, scary per se. But once you make them basically, like, a full-sized human being, it doesn't seem quite so silly.
Yeah. I mean, there's something to that idea. Aging him down might have been interesting, too. More of like a Gage and Pet Cemetery kind of thing could have been.
There basically would have been no 10 years later moment. He would have just been a toddler the whole time.
Well, but then it would have actually depicted that them coming to terms with this decision to raise this alien entity as their own. Because as it is, we don't get any of that. And that was kind of a problem for me. Like, once it takes a surprising amount of time for either of the parents to introduce that into the squabbles that they start having once Brandon starts acting out.
Yeah.
Like, they're just like, oh, it's just puberty, you know, this, that, or all these more pedestrian explanations. And maybe they're in denial. That in itself could be kind of interesting. But eventually one of them just goes, like, you know, he looks like us, but he's not like us. I say one of them. It was definitely the dad.
Yeah, it's Kyle.
And it's kind of like, and they've both known that from the beginning. And that's sort of creates pacing issues for me because, like, at least in The Prodigy, you said that The Prodigy had less going on than this movie, which is true. But one thing that it did have was that period of uncertainty where the parent gets to be a skeptic about the whole situation. And granted, that arc is usually tedious. You just kind of want them to get the gist of what's going on so that the movie can actually get to business. But it's kind of important for the parent to not know what's up and then figure out what's up. These parents know that their kid is an alien from birth, essentially, what passes for birth in this scenario. So them being so slow on the uptake, I found pretty aggravating. So that's one way in which The Prodigy is structured a little bit better, although it is still a weaker movie than Brightburn overall. Although I think I like Brightburn a little less than you did.
Yeah.
I wasn't too crazy about it.
I get that vibe.
Yeah, I don't know. The kid spends a lot of time once he comes into his powers, like I've been saying, zipping all over the place. And that is, I think, you know, taken straight from the Zack Snyder Superman movies, which in itself is kind of an issue for me because the whole, you know, depending on how you feel about those movies, the whole what if Superman but evil question has kind of already been answered.
Yeah.
By Man of Steel and by Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice. So him constantly moving like Henry Cavill's Superman makes the whole thing feel a little Snydery in a way that, I don't know, it kind of takes the like nihilist dickhead Superman idea from those movies and turns it up to 11 in a way that could have been kind of provocative if those movies had been more widely liked, but they weren't really. They were really divisive, so it doesn't feel like it's really taking on a sacred cow.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
The adjective Snydery is almost never a good thing.
Right. And him zipping around constantly, it isn't as scary as it could be because fast lateral movement, like people very quickly entering or exiting the frame from left or right, is used for sight gags more than anything, I find, like for visual comedy. So for, you know, like the sheriff getting vroom, just roadrunnered off the porch isn't funny. Like I didn't laugh, but it isn't, right. it doesn't tickle my scary bone either. There's something a little bit too Looney Tunes about it.
Yeah, it's a little bit off.
When you see the like trail of viscera that he's left behind, that helps a little, but
that,
but even that
does carry it a little bit.
Right.
You're right. Yeah, I don't think there was a way to fit that effect into this movie in a way that was effective just based on this movie's visual DNA. Like I'm thinking of the movie Pulse, the original, the Japanese film. I haven't seen the remake, which I hear is not great.
I hear it's a mid-2000s Japanese American remake. Horror movie.
Although I like The Ring well enough.
Yeah, I like The Ring well enough too.
Anyway, in the Japanese Pulse film, there is a sequence that at the time nearly made me shit my pants. That's kind of hyperbole, but maybe not really.
No, it's terrifying. It is genuinely bone chilling. I mean, that's one of the scarier things I've beheld on a movie screen. It feels like a genuine encounter with something paranormal.
Yeah, there's this ghost that's at one end of a room and kind of like jerk warps halfway across the room and not like in a straight line.
There's something kind of balletic about it and sort of slow and it's clumsy and graceful at the same time, and it's not the kind of herky jerky twitchy Silent Hill kind of thing that you're probably imagining if you haven't seen the movie. It really is like nothing else I've ever seen. It's very, very spooky.
Yeah, and so sort of abrupt movement can work. That's the example I'm pointing to of it working. But yeah, I think it's because it's sort of, in this movie, it's in one side of frame and out the other just all at once.
Right.
Or just in and out in general. It doesn't work quite as well. And I don't know how this movie, this is what I was talking about with visual DNA, with the way the movie's shot, I don't think there was any room for Brandon to do some kind of like creepy jump movement within the frame of a shot without like leaving it and coming back.
Yeah, sure.
And that might not have even worked in this instance, but I'm just trying to figure out how it might have.
I mean, I like the idea of them taking the language of superhero action cinema and turning it on its head and trying to make it scary. I just think that doing that for the DC cinematic universe, it doesn't have the same weight as if they'd somehow found a way to do it for Marvel. Like I feel like that then you risk being ridiculous. But I feel like, I don't know, what do you make the kid like really quippy or something? Like, I don't know, that is kind of a harebrained notion. But I just feel like this movie would feel like more of a rebuke to the superhero zeitgeist we're living to if it was riffing on Marvel somehow rather than the late to the party, less well-regarded, less popular DC movies. I know that the DC stuff is rebounding now, but it's not because of Superman, you know?
No.
So that connection doesn't work.
Yeah.
Or maybe if they'd riffed more on Christopher Reeve somehow, like if he wasn't so fucking fast, that could have been really unnerving because that's the version of Superman that springs to mind most readily for most people, I think, and is still beloved. So maybe they could have done it that way. I don't know.
Yeah.
Brandon's whole characterization never really worked for me. I mean, they play up this idea at the beginning that he's something of a child prodigy, with, you know, him knowing a bunch about bees and wasps and what have you, and just generally being very bright because he's got an alien brain in his skull. But they don't do that much with it. In fact, he makes kind of a bunch of sloppy mistakes. I mean, but he's kind of above consequence because he's impervious to damage, so he can kind of do whatever he wants. So he doesn't have to be clever, but I think that they abandon, like, it never feels like he outsmarts anybody.
No.
He's just kind of a brute, and I think that that's a missed opportunity because they do play up the idea that he's smarter than other kids near the beginning, and they really don't do anything with it. I'm thinking specifically of, he's very easily distracted when he goes to his aunt's house to kill her specifically so that she won't talk to the sheriff about what a little fledgling school shooter he's turning into.
Which, if I can divert just real quickly.
By all means.
A lot's made of him killing people, specifically would be his aunt and eventually his uncle. Because
so they don't blow the whistle on him,
so they don't blow the whistle to his parents, and like, why does he give a shit?
Right.
That's,
and also
never,
this
made
is just
clear.
Guaranteed to draw more attention,
right,
and put your parents even more on edge and get you further up shit creek.
Yeah, like you said, he's above consequences, so what, like, why does he care?
Yeah,
and it'll also be worse.
And he's clearly not trying to keep a low profile. He's committing very public acts of murder and mayhem
and leaving a signature.
Exactly. So it's gonna get back to your parents, you little dumbass, you know, like, so yeah, the whole child prodigy thing goes out the window. Plus, he doesn't even do what he showed up to do. He doesn't kill his aunt, he kills his uncle just because he happened to make fun of his, you know,
mask.
weird burlap mask. Yeah, so it's he's just, there's no calculation there, and that kind of makes watching his increasingly bloody antics just a little irksome to me. They also never resolve this issue wherein, so going into this movie, I kind of expected it to be a power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely kind of parable, where an angsty little kid finds out that he can't be killed and is capable of limitless carnage and kind of, you know, just goes ballistic. But it doesn't seem like there's a little bit of that, but more than anything, he's just kind of this weird alien parasite. Like, they try to have it both ways, especially near the beginning of the movie where he keeps going into those trances and then he wakes up from them and he's a normal kid again. So,
yeah.
So then it's like a Jekyll Hyde thing where it's a 50-50 split. But then later in the movie, those trances just stop, but he just kind of, I don't know if there's some kind of synthesis that happens. If so, it's not really depicted or communicated very well. But that's that question of, like, is it just a confused kid succumbing to dark impulses, or is he obeying some kind of hive mind and he really has no say in the matter? I definitely think the former is more interesting, but it seems like this movie leans more heavily on the latter.
Yeah, I couldn't keep track of that. It's like, early on, it feels like he's a super powerful alien, like Manchurian candidate almost. Like, he's a perfectly normal, he's a sweet kid, and then all of a sudden he gets the Captain Marco, you know, like, he gets the signal, and then he hears his trigger phrase, and suddenly he's a murderous psychopath. And then, yeah, at some point that just becomes the default, and he's just, that's him all the time. And it's not, yeah, as Matt said, it's not clear when that changeover to permanence takes place and why.
Yeah, but even then, even when he's gone full supervillain, essentially, when you'd think he, you know, oh, he's gone full alien, he still cares about petty middle school drama bullshit, like whether his crush likes him or not. You know, like, he's still lashing out at people due to some kind of internal human motivation. Like, he never goes full, the movie never goes full cosmic horror, which I think is problematic for me. I don't know. I think that it could have been, if they'd taken that schismatic characterization from the first act and gone all the way with it, that could have been heartbreaking if he gets the kryptonite, whatever, through the chest and is suddenly his regular self again. Or if, like, he keeps snapping in and out of it, and you commit to the Jekyll Hyde thing, that would have been a completely different movie, but it would have been a little bit more,
Would have packed more of a punch.
A little bit. Or they could have gone completely the opposite way and not even invoked the idea of a hive mind. And it's all Brandon all the time just making bad choices the way children do. That also would have been a different movie and probably a better one. So, I don't know. I just think that because they're trying to do both, Brandon hits peak evil way too quickly for me. And then the movie kind of plateaus.
Yeah.
Like, basically, once he crushes that girl's hand, you're just kind of counting the minutes. At least I was.
Yeah, and I mean, even if you don't call that the tipping point, the fact is he murders the girl's mom at, like, no later than the halfway point of the film.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, you've committed murder, gruesome murder.
Mm-hmm.
You're there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's never any question of actually reforming him, which... I don't know, it kind of feels like a little xenophobic to me. I'm not going to get on that soapbox, but I feel like the Superman origin story is such an earnest, open-hearted kind of immigrant story that then to do this, you know, in 2019 feels a little politically loaded to me. I'm sure that wasn't intentional, but whenever you take an optimistic thing and flip it upside down, you're going to end up with something more acerbic and kind of nasty. So, yeah, I don't know. It's fine. Whatever. Aliens are bad. I can live with that. It's not the first evil alien movie.
Certainly won't be the last.
No. On the subject of Superman, though, and I said before the break that I wish that they'd been more rigorous about having Brandon stick to Superman's power set. And granted, especially in the comics, Superman can basically do whatever the fuck he wants. So even that probably would have been too expansive. Like, I don't want to see Brightburn do frost breath or something like that.
Yeah.
Or like fly around the world so fast that he turns time the other way and starts like the flow of time flowing in reverse. None of that, please. But it seems like there are things that Brandon can do in this movie that maybe he shouldn't be able to do. Like, if he actually does lift the truck with his mind, jury's out on that one. I don't think that he should be able to do that. And I don't think he should be able to fuck with technology the way he does, mostly just because it's kind of hack. It's just very haunted house to have the radio suddenly go on the fritz or have the car not start or any of that stuff. It's just, it makes this much more of a true blue horror movie, but not in an interesting way, just in a way that makes it feel even less novel. Like, even if you've never seen Swamp Thing, Darkman, Earth versus the Spider, Toxic Avenger, I haven't seen most of those movies, but even if you've seen any horror movie in the last 5-10 years, you've seen Brightburn, basically, at least in terms of the prelude to the bloodletting, all of the girl in her bedroom and her laptop keeps opening itself and playing a spooky song. That kind of stuff is just very rote. But on the flip side, there's stuff that Superman can do that Brandon apparently cannot. Like, there's a bunch of conversations between the mom and dad in this movie that Brandon really should have been privy to if he has
super hearing
or any augmented hearing at all. Or frankly, just normal human ears, because it's not a big house. You know, I mean, where I grew up, the walls were kind of thin. You could hear it when my parents were fighting. Like, there's information. The whole, he's not like us. He looks like us, but he's not like us. We found him in the woods.
I just was waiting for the shot of, like, Brandon standing in his own doorway.
Yeah, exactly. He wouldn't even need his ear pressed against the wall. Again, whether he's got super hearing or not, he should have. But it's maybe more interesting if he hears it from a superhuman distance. But yeah, that I feel like should have been within his abilities. And I don't know, you could maybe do something fun with X-ray vision, do like a predator eye view kind of thing, like a, not thermal vision, but you know, something where it would have made the cat and mouse stuff a little bit more dynamic.
Yeah, there's really nothing from Brandon's perspective.
Yeah, that's
in
true.
In this movie, visually. It's all just observing him from a distance, and that was probably meant to like heighten the suspense, because we don't know where he is, but I don't think it really did that.
No, not especially. There is one scene I liked until it went off the rails a little bit, right before Ma and Pa Kent show up at the morgue to console the aunt. The dad has a nightmare in which his wife has gone out to the wreck of the alien spaceship.
Oh God, I forgot about that.
And she picks up this her bundle of joy. and says, look, someone heard our prayers. It's a blessing. Because again, one of them is infertile, or, you know, they've been having trouble. Who knows? And he looks at the bundle and blood is just dripping from it in a thick current. Yeah. And
eventually blood is coming out of Tori's mouth and eye sockets.
Yeah, which is when the scene lost me, because it gets a little too like baby's first creepypasta right there a little bit. And the eyes were bleeding and this. And then, you know, he looks into the bundle and sees kind of satanic glowing red eyes, and then the baby face lunges at the camera, which is like, okay, that was the only scene in the movie that actually got under my skin until it overstayed its welcome. Yeah, it turned the dial up a little too much. But yeah, I mean, I wanted to I always try to give credit where credit is due. This movie is honestly, frankly, a little bit better than I'm making it out to be. It just really didn't do anything for me.
Yeah. We've avoided mentioning actor names up to this point, which is unusual.
It is.
Elizabeth Banks, who has worked with James Gunn before in the vastly superior Slither, plays Tori, plays Brandon's mom. She's good. No issues there. The dad, played by David Denman.
Just a hulking lumberjack of a man.
Really a colossus.
Just a brick shit house.
Also solid. Really, the performances are generally not objectionable.
Yeah, pretty good. I found no fault with any of the performances. I mean, child actors are always a little iffy, but the kid who plays Brandon does what he can.
Yeah, I've
already complained about the writing, so yeah, I'm not gonna ascribe problems with that character to some 12-year-old.
But yeah, I mean, overall, Brightburn, not a terrible way to spend like an hour and a half, but you could do better.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably better than Earth versus the Spider. I don't know. Haven't seen it. One of these days, I'll tackle that personal demon. Any movie on a Blockbuster shelf that creeped me out between the ages of like 8 and 11 is like on my to-do list forever. Like, no matter how schlocky or stupid it is, like I have to face my fears. Also, there's a scene where Brandon massacres a shitload of chickens. We forgot to talk about that.
Yep.
That happens also weirdly early in the movie and doesn't raise as many red flags as it could or should. So just mentally insert that into our synopsis, if you will. And every time we complain about how slow on the uptake the parents are, just pretend that they also have a shitload of chicken entrails that's fallen into their lap that they can't account for. It just makes the whole thing even more, I don't know, even harder to take seriously.
Indeed.
On that note,
this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Brightburn, official trailer number 2, uploaded by Sony Pictures Entertainment. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, June 16th, and we'll be discussing Ma, an Octavia Spencer torments teenagers flick from Blumhouse. See you then.